Hey everyone, welcome to the New Insight podcast, where we interview the most important movers and shakers in ophthalmology and give you new insights on the innovations ahead. I'm your host, Viral Sheth. My guest today is Jay Duker. Dr. Duker is President and Chief Operating Officer of EyePoint Pharmaceuticals, a company that, if you've been listening to the industry news recently, you know is making waves in our space. Prior to leading clinical development and operations at EyePoint, Dr. Duker was Director of the New England Eye Center and Chair of Ophthalmology at Tufts Medical Center. He's co-founded multiple companies in the biotech space and really has been at the center of retina for more than 30 years. In our conversation, we touch on a number of topics. We talk about his 21 years as chairman at Tufts and how it prepared him for this current phase of his career. We talk about the important relationship between clinicians and industry and how successful companies seem to do a really good job leveraging those relationships and insights. Of course, we talk about the current biotech that Dr. Duker and the EyePoint team are working on, some of the unmet needs they hope to address, and the way the landscape has changed and will continue to change in the years to come. We then dive into what I think was probably my favorite part of the conversation when Jay discusses his role in the development of OCT technology. At one point in time, Jay had the only OCT machine on the planet, and we talk about how far we've come since then with discussions about how OCT machines may be in every patient's home sooner rather than later. Anyone that's just entering ophthalmology now really will benefit from that bit of history, that walk down memory lane. We wrap up the conversation with a look to the future and discuss what we think will be the next OCT machine over the next decade. I'm thrilled to be able to give our listeners some new insights from one of the true giants in our field. So without further delay, please enjoy my conversation with Dr. Jay Duker. So Jay, thank you for coming on the show. We really appreciate having you. I'm very excited to talk to you today in a landscape where things are changing and there's a lot of exciting things happening. So welcome to the show.
Thank you, Viral. Happy to be here.
Yeah, so let's just dive right in. You know, tell us about, you know, your role right now. You know, you're at EyePoint. You know, a lot of people that are probably tuning in know Jay Duker, the chairman of Tufts, right? Which you were at for 20 years. And recently in 2021, you took a full-time position at EyePoint. Tell us a little bit about that. I know you had worked with them previously to that on doing some board work. Where did that kind of that pathway happen and how did it happen?
Well, first of all, I have to say, you know, I really enjoyed my tenure at Tufts. It's a great department and it really allowed me a lot of personal growth. But at some point, you have to realize that it's time to pass things along to the next generation. And 21 years was a long time being chair. I think I built a great department clinically and from a research perspective, but it was time from the big picture. For me personally, you know, we've got a great field. We are just so lucky to be able to do what we do at the time that we do it. And while I really love clinical practice and love surgery, I really needed personally another challenge. I was too young to hit the beaches of Florida. So I decided to try something a little bit new, a little bit different. And I'm really excited by not only the product that we're developing at EyePoint, but the team that I'm working with. So yeah, the background was back in 2016, I got invited to join the board of directors of EyePoint to give them a little insight from a retinal specialist perspective on the products they were developing. And our current CEO, Nancy Lurker, who I have the greatest respect for, Nancy, after a couple years, said to me, you know, Jay, you'd be more valuable in the company than on the board as an independent director. Would you consider helping us with strategy part-time? And I said, well, as long as I don't have to give up my day job at Tufts, sure. Tufts was fine with it. EyePoint was fine with it. So for a year or so, I was part-time at EyePoint helping with strategy. And eventually she came back to me and said, Jay, what would you ever consider coming here full time? And it was the right time for me. As I said, I wanted a new challenge. And so a year and a half later, a president, chief operating officer, and it's been a great year and a half. It really has, punctuated by a lot of accomplishments, hard work in a different way. You know, we work hard as retina specialists, but this is different. Although I have to say some of the skills you learn as an administrator of a department are the same skills you need in business.
So let me, I want to make a couple of comments. One is, I think the fact that iPoint brought you in early, I think just speaks to some of the things that we see in our space, which are maybe not unique, but I think why we have seen so much progress in our field, which is, you know, these companies, not only are they innovative, but they bring us in early, they get our input early, early and often. And right. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, your example is a great example. And we've seen a couple of these in the space, which is, hey, let's bring in really, you know, important people in our field, get their input. And then if we can, you know, have them continue to lead kind of the charge for us. And I think, really there's no one better than someone that's had your history and, dude, to your point, some of the administrative experience. And so I think that says a lot for the company, iPoint in particular, in this case, it says a lot about them. And so let's talk about iPoint. So what was it in 2016 that excited you about the company? And then, more recently, and, we've done some of the clinical trial work with you and your team. And so we're equally excited. But for the listeners that maybe aren't as experienced with the iPoint kind of platform, with 1901, with TKIs in general, tell us a little bit about what you guys are working on and why you're excited about it.
Well, the why I was excited about it and why I joined in 2016 starts way back. So before the company was iPoint, it was called Cyvita, with a small P, big S. And before that, it was called Control Delivery Systems. And I actually got involved with the technology right out of fellowship, almost 30 years ago. Their first product was the ganciclovir implant. And I was the second person ever to put a ganciclovir implant into an eye. And I probably put more in than anybody else, over 300. And so I had a lot of experience with the technology. And the inventor of the technology, Paul Ashton, I actually helped recruit him to Tufts. And he was a professor at Tufts for a while before he left to start the company Control Delivery Systems. So I knew about the technology for decades. And it's been in four FDA-approved products now, Vitrasert, Retisert, Iluvien, which is essentially the same as Yutiq, but marketed by Alimera. And the delivery system, the Durasert delivery system, is safe, effective, and has been used in over 80,000 patients. So it's a really good platform for sustained delivery to the eye. So now you say, okay, what about a tyrosine kinase inhibitor in wet AMD? What's that all about? Well, I think if you look at our space now, basically, we've got a lot of good anti-VEGFs. They work well as anti-permeability agents, and they're very safe, but they don't last very long. And with the huge influx of patients we have with the aging population and now FDA-approved injections for geographic atrophy, I think all of us retina specialists would welcome the opportunity to safely move some of our patients into a less frequent injection schedule. So that's the idea behind coupling a small molecule tyrosine kinase inhibitor like vorolanib with a sustained delivery system that we hope to be able to take out a majority of wet AMD eyes safely and effectively with a tolerable intravitreal insert that lasts at least 6 months or longer. So it's a bit of a holy grail. Obviously we've got other technologies that have been worked on, the port delivery system by Genentech is essentially trying to do the same thing using a surgical device. Of course, gene therapy as well, although that's a little bit on the other side with a one and done, but that shows certainly efficacy promise as well. So this is an area of really active research, not just our small molecule, TKI with a delivery system. There are several other companies developing those as well, along with, as I said, other ideas for sustained drug delivery. So I think the exciting part is that we're going to see more and more innovation in our space over the next few years, which gives us and our patients more options and more flexibility.
Yeah, no, I think that's great. I mean, you hit on kind of the key points, right? What are we looking at in kind of this current phase of research and development for our AMD and DME patients? It's efficacy, of course, but durability, mm-hmm. I think, is huge. I mean, you mentioned just this influx of patients now with geographic atrophy and potentially other unmet needs along the way. We're going to need to kind of figure out the balance. And I think you're right. Durability is a big one. So, what are the highlights of some of the data that you guys have presented recently? And when you take that in context, where do you see this kind of being positioned? Should, hopefully, unfortunately, if we get to approval and then from a marketing standpoint, where that sits?
So I'm going to take the second part first. Yeah. Where do I see this fitting in? Because this really is a bit of a paradigm shift. We are testing our drug, EYP-1901, which is vorolanib and erodible Durasert, as a maintenance therapy. We haven't tested it as newly diagnosed naive patients, and there's no current plan to do that in the near future. We believe the value here is maintenance. The idea being, get your patient as dry and as good seeing as you can with monthly injections of whatever large molecule you choose, high-dose Eylea, Vabysmo, biosimilar, doesn't matter. Once you've achieved as good as you can get them, hand them over to EYP-1901, and we believe at least 50% we can take out 6 months or longer. So that was based again on our phase one trial called the DAVIO trial, where we enrolled 17 patients, all previously treated maintenance therapy. All of the patients would receive a standard of care injection on day one. Then a week later, they got our drug in four different doses, and then we watched them. And 53% made it up to 6 months with no rescue. And interestingly, a third of them made it a full year without rescue. Now, we plan on testing and developing EYP-1901 as a Q6-month injection. And so that's what we will be doing in our planned pivotal trials. And the reason, again, is what we all like is retina specialist flexibility. So if we believe the drug can work for 9 months or a year, you might say, well, why not go for 9 months or a year? The answer is, well, it's not going to work in everybody that long. And wouldn't it be nice to be able to reinject somebody earlier if the label allows you to? So we're going at this point for an every 6 month label, even though we know that some of the patients will be able to go longer safely. Now, some of the critical things here is, and I said up to 50%, we think perhaps in the phase two, we might do a little bit better than that. But the point is, we don't have to work in everybody. We're not taking the old paradigm of saying, hey, you're using drug X now. We're introducing drug Y. Drug Y is better than drug X. You don't need to stock drug X anymore. Just use us. We're not saying that at all. We're saying, you know, you're still going to use your large molecule of choice. And you may occasionally supplement in between the 6 to 9 month duration of our insert with a large molecule. There's nothing wrong with that. But we think at least 50% of eyes, you won't need to do that. So it's a bit of a paradigm shift. And again, we believe that if we can identify the patients for the retina community ahead of time who do best with our drug, once it's approved, obviously, if you know who it's going to work best in, your personal experience can be even better. But you can play worst case scenario. Say, Jay, you know, suppose I try EYP-1901 and after 2 months I see recurrent fluid. Well, you don't have to use it again. It's erodible. It's going to go away. You can try something else. It isn't permanently surgically placed. It isn't gene therapy. But there may be some arguments I can give you that even if you do need to supplement, you might still consider using a 1901. And first argument is what I call the insurance policy. Once you start getting out 3 months, 4 months between visits, what if that patient gets sick? What if they go on vacation, they miss a visit? If you've got a long-acting drug on board, you feel a little bit better that if they can't come in, that they're going to be covered. Finally, you know, we may be neuroprotective. We just presented some data at ARVO in an animal model that suggested vorolanib is neuroprotective against outer retinal loss in a retinal detachment model. Now, obviously, you have to show that clinically, but if we can show even a subgroup of patients under maintenance therapy improve their vision against a control group getting treated on label, well, that might be something that would really push people to say, you know, why not use this? I might be able to give 25% or so of my patients improved vision with this insert. So it is a bit of a paradigm shift, and we understand that. On the other hand, I think that this would be a very effective part of our armamentarium should it be safe, effective, and tolerable.
Yeah, and see, I think this is another reason why a company like EyePoint is well served by having someone that has experience like you, because when you say paradigm shift, I mean it's all changing, right? Even the way we're doing clinical trials now, even the way we're thinking about these as retina specialists of, we're going to have these tools in our toolbox, and it's not just, monthly or Q8 week anti-VEGFs anymore, right? So we're going to have to get a little more, savvy and really selective on, who we're treating and how we're treating them and what that kind of cookbook is for each individual patient. So, kind of a personalized treatment approach. And I think, solutions like this are going to help us start thinking like that more than just, you know, kind of standard intravitreal agents that we're kind of used to, right, over the last.
Well, you've hit the nail on the head, Viral, because we individualize treatment. Yeah. We don't necessarily treat on label. Yeah. You know, 20% of EYLEA patients can go 3 months or longer. That's what the statistics in the real world say. They don't have a label for 3 months or longer right now. But we do it because we feel it's safe and effective. So that is one of the critical things to understanding the way we all think as retina specialists, is we want to individualize therapy, and we have the tools right in front of us to do it. We can look in the eye, we can check the vision, we can talk to the patient, we can do an OCT. And that those data points help us say this eye is under control or it's not under control, and then lead to alterations in the paradigm. So whatever the label says, I can almost guarantee the retina specialist will modify it in the real world.
Yeah. Yeah. And we do it, right. And I think the real world data suggests that we don't always do it to the benefit of, you know, outcomes in patients, right? I think, you know, you talk about, we're just not good at injecting frequently. Right. Yep. And I think because of that, our real world, you know, results are not always as good as what we see in clinical trials. And I think it's treatments like this, these durable agents that are good for, you know, many, many of our patients that are going to help us get to those outcomes in the real world that match maybe what we are seeing in clinical trials historically. Right.
So I will also say you've made another really important point, which is we all believe we're doing the right thing with our patients with treat and extend. And we all do it. The stats are overwhelming. Yet the real world data suggests that in the first year of treatment, we give back almost all the visual acuity improvement that we got with the first 3 months. But yeah, it's physically impossible to treat patients monthly. We just don't have the bandwidth and they don't have the energy and they're going to miss visits. So again, the idea of using sustained release, either on its own or running in the background, you know, every other chronic disease, look at hypertension. You put a beta blocker on top of hydrochlorothiazide. Almost every other chronic disease is like that, but wet AMD is not. We still use an acute type therapy. So yeah, I think the paradigm is going to shift, provided we as companies can come through with the right data.
Yeah. And, you know, and even in our diabetics, right, we're looking at, you know, short-term agents, long-term agents, you know, we're seeing insulin last a lot longer. So we'll circle back on the diabetic conversation and maybe kind of how you see the NPDR paradigm changing and maybe even some of the trials you're currently running and what the expectation is as far as results go. But before we get into that, you know, you said you gave a lot of historical context and kind of the company and where it came from. You know, with a previous podcast, I got some feedback on, you know, people really kind of liking that trip down memory lane. And I was talking to my fellow in the OR last week and we were talking about, well, what should we ask Jay? And I was thinking about it. And that fellow was born right around the time your first few OCT papers came out, right? Yeah. So I know we're all getting older, Jay, but you know, what, you know, when you look back at that, like, so we're talking like, you know, early mid 90s, right? And some of the clinical work, I just want to talk for a few minutes about that because I think there's going to be listeners listening to this podcast that assume that OCT has been around forever, that it's been, you know, it's a machine that exists in every retina specialist clinics and many ophthalmologists and optometry clinics, right? But that wasn't always the case. And so tell us a little bit about that and I'm specifically asking you because of how important your role was in all of that.
So it wasn't the case. And so at one point we had the only OCT machine in the world at Tufts. You know, when I was first brought over from MIT, the prototype, Carmen Pulifito, Joel Schumann were innovators who had worked with Jim Fujimoto, who's really the grandfather of OCT on this. And they brought it over and they said, Jay, start doing some patients on this. And I'm going, what do we need this for? I could look in with a lens and see what's going on in the macula. So I was a skeptic for about a month. And then I imaged a macular hole patient with it. And I went, oh, my God. This is unbelievable. And so I would go give lectures on it. I remember giving talks, and because we had the only machine, I would show pictures and people would say, this is amazing. And at the end, they'd raise their hand and say, you know what? I don't need this. I don't need this machine because I can diagnose what I need to diagnose at the slit lamp. And in some ways it was true, but two things happened that made this indispensable. The first is successful macular hole surgery, first reported in 1990. And we all said, oh, wow, I get 50% of my macular holes closed. I got 70%. But it was all based on us looking in, saying, is that hole closed or not? Now we had a machine that said, yeah, you closed it, or no, you didn't. And the other big thing was medical treatments. We reported the first use, it was Adam Martinez, was the first author on the paper, of intravitreal Kenalog in diabetic macular edema. And the only reason we knew it worked was an OCT, because the visual acuity didn't always improve on those chronic patients. So once you had that, and then all of a sudden, Phil Rosenfeld with intravitreal Avastin, it became a necessity to have an OCT to tell you anatomically what was going on. So that really, it wasn't just the technology being so wonderful. It was the fact that we now had ability to treat macular disease, both medically and surgically, and needed an instrument to show you that.
Well, what's crazy now, Jay, think about that. So you had the only OCT machine on the planet, and now we're on the verge of maybe in the next few years, many, many people having this in their home and doing scans. You know,
Amazing.
we tie it back to personalized treatments and how we tailor it to the individual. You know, just to watch that arc and see where the technology was and you know, how people like you kind of really evangelized for it, right? If you're talking, giving these lectures and people saying, yeah, I don't really need
Don't need
this,
it.
there's been many technologies that have died that way, right? And so the fact that we're here where we're at, again, I just wanted to kind of take that short trip down memory lane to give people context, right?
Well, I could put it into 2023. We have one now, OCTA. A lot of us use it. I like it. It's a very good diagnostic tool. It will tell you if the eye is vascularized or not, but it doesn't really help us with management. We've had it for 10 years now. How many times do we alter what we do with an anti-VEGF based on OCTA? We don't. So what's OCTA really good for? Telling you if the vessels are open or closed. Once we have the ability to revascularize the retina, well, then we're going to need OCTA because that. So it's a diagnostic device that doesn't have a therapeutic match to it yet, and that's why, again, we use it, but it isn't indispensable the way OCT is. I'll tell you though, what is going to be coming up, and the OCTs can do this, is measure geographic atrophy for us. And show the quantification of the atrophy to get a timeline in a course for the year leading up to when you start to intervene medically, and then at the following year to then look at a patient and say, did I actually alter the course of that GA? If the answer is no, you might choose to stop using the medicine. But if the answer is yes, and in fact, we may find there's a subgroup of patients who we halt GA completely. It's not just slow it down. There may be a subgroup, but we'll need that tool. We'll need that OCT or, frankly, quantified autofluorescence to help us. So I would expect that the companies will be hot on the trail of that.
So let's talk about Jay for a second, because as a clinician, you know what a huge issue it's been, and you've clearly been in rooms with patients where we get frustrated because our message to that patient is, hey, not a lot I can do for you, right? And now, so we're in those early innings now where we've got some therapeutics either here or on the way shortly, and the question is, what do you see happening with GA? I know you mentioned, where we could be going and maybe stratifying better over time. Are you excited about where we're at? What's your thought process on it, especially as someone that saw kind of VEGF, anti-VEGFs come out and the evolution of those and being part of that evolution?
I'd start even earlier. How about PDT? PDT was approved for wet AMD, but it slowed the disease down. And you did it quarterly on a lot of patients, and they went from 2080 to 2100 after a year. And you had to convince them, if I didn't do it, you'd be 2400. We're in the same boat right now with complement inhibition. If you look across the board, complement inhibition works, but nobody's really shown much more than 20% reduction across the board. My first point I made already, there may be subgroups of patients who do much better with complement inhibition, and we need to be able to identify them. The second point is that it's really not the 20% efficacy. That's low, relatively speaking, but we'd all take that if we didn't have to inject it monthly. It's a huge burden on family, on patients, on us, in a relatively old population to do that. But are there going to be patients who want it? Absolutely. We all have them. They've lost one eye to GA and they know the other eye's going. And they'll come in every week if it would preserve their vision. So the idea of building, we built on PDT, we built on Macugen. Get it out there, learn who it works in, learn who it doesn't work in. And maybe this, I don't think any of us believe that the product that we have now or the products that are coming are going to be the final products, 5 or 10 years from now. But this is a really important advance for us. And the only way we continue to advance is to use it in patients and see how it works and learn from that. So yeah, sustained release, of course, we're working. We've got a deal with a company called Rallybio, who has a C5 inhibitor that we're trying to put in sustained release. And obviously, there's a lot of other companies out there who've got the same idea. Certainly, gene therapy, a company that I started with my colleagues at Tufts called Hemera Biosciences, now owned by Janssen. They're developing, our intravitreal AAV to block a membrane attack complex. So yeah, that would be terrific if we could do a one and done in GA. But we don't know the whole story yet. Complement blocking, it seems to have an effect, but I think you're going to see other pathways down the road too.
Yeah, it's fascinating, and it's an exciting time for sure. So we'll see. And I think you're right. It's an area, therapeutic area, that's ripe for, durable agents, long acting, maybe some one and dones that are being looked at. I think it's a perfect kind of space for that. So, we talked about EYP-1901. I want to circle back because I know we've focused a little bit more on the wet AMD side of things, but you guys are also working on NPDR, right? We talked about, you mentioned something about treatment burden, right? And a lot of, we already have agents we can use for NPDR. We just don't use them, right? We don't use these on diabetic patients because patients are reluctant to come in for frequent injections. So again, talking about, GA, but NPDR is another place where a durable agent that works is potentially, a game changer, right? So talk to us a little bit about what you guys are looking at, and then potentially with these studies, when you're looking at results.
Sure. So first of all, from an overall market perspective, the data that we have is that of all the addressable market in the United States of moderate to severe NPDR, about 10% is currently getting treated, 2 to 3% with anti-VEGFs and the rest with laser. Laser has the advantage of being durable. That's why we like it. It's not without side effect, but it is durable. Interestingly, in Europe, they do also treat NPDR, but almost exclusively with laser because they don't have the anti-VEGFs on label there. So what we're trying to do again is recognize that anti-VEGF agents can reverse diabetic retinopathy in a significant number of patients, but the treatment burden is significant. It's monthly induction followed by quarterly or every 4 months. And that's a lot for patients and doctors who, and the patients, as you know, don't have necessarily an immediate sense of a benefit. It's you have to show them a photograph and explain to them, hey, look how bad it was now, and 2 years later, look how good it is. The other issue around it is the potential non-compliance. We know diabetics, 50% of them don't come in for eye exams anyway. And the problem is not so much there'll be a complication, but if they miss visits and they don't come in for the regimen, it's also pretty clear that they reverse the benefits pretty quickly. So if you have an agent that can last 9 months or a year safely and effectively, most of us are following these patients every 6 months, 9 months, 1 year. That's right in that kind of wheelhouse. You're not asking people to come in any sooner. And provided it's safe and it works, and frankly, it doesn't even have to work quite as well as an Eylea would to be accepted, I think, by patients and by doctors. And again, it may be a subgroup who it works on, and we may be able to identify them. So it may not be necessarily, we'll say, use on everybody. We may say, here, these are the patients who it really works very well on, and that can really cut down on the potential for visual loss or the conversion to PDR-DME. So we'll see. So we're in a phase two trial called PAVIA, and we should have the trial fully enrolled very soon. It's a 9-month endpoint, so we should have data on the PAVIA trial the first half, probably second quarter of next year. The study is 2 different doses of EYP-1901, approximately 2 milligrams versus 3 milligrams, and it's a sham control, which is interesting because the FDA still appears to allow companies in their pivotal trials for NPDR to use a sham control, even though there are 2 approved products, because the standard of care really is observation. It's a bit of a faster study to recruit for because in this 9-month study, we're just injecting them once. And or not at all, or they're getting a sham. So it's been a fairly easy study to recruit for, I would say, with enthusiasm between, the doctors and the patients. So we should have top line results, next year. And if they look good, we will go into 2 pivotal trials. And what we hope to do is open up kind of the new market for it. And you know, doctors who are reluctant to give that many injections may not be reluctant to do it just once a year.
Yeah, and I think one of the fascinating things about that study is how quickly it recruited, right? I think that to me tells me that the value proposition for a patient, it's easier than saying, hey, I'm going to give you a bunch of loading doses of monthly injections and then maybe space them out to quarterly, right? And I think that's huge because for us, we've been, a lot of us want to use these agents because we know we can make them better, but we know the treatment burden is just, it's just too much for patients.
And from the recruiting perspective too, if you're involved in Pavia, which I think you are, if you recall the visit, it's not month, it's monthly at the beginning and then it's quarterly. So we're
Quarterly,
not
yeah.
doing, so if you've got a young working patient who you say, look, I want to do a 1 year study on you, have to come in every month.
Yeah.
I don't want to come in every month. That's really
Yeah.
hard.
Well, it just speaks to the treatment burden issue, especially in that subset of patients that we have. So no, good. So I'm gonna start to bring it to a close, but I wanna kind of wrap it up by saying, you know, you were there when OCT was kind of coming into existence, and you, if not immediately, quickly identified it as something that was going to, you know, change the game and change the paradigm and how we practice in our level of quality of practice, right? So what are you seeing today that might be, you know, in its nascent stage, but something that may be that 20 years from now? Is it is and I'm not going to let you say EYP-1901, so I'm going to refuse you from any of
Well,
that. But yeah. But
okay.
like, and and we mentioned a couple of things like gene therapy. We've mentioned things we haven't mentioned, some things like AI or just
That's
personal treatment intervals or whatever it is. So tell me a little bit about what you think 20 years
well,
from now
you
we're going to
took the
say.
words out of my mouth, and
Okay.
AI is really the
Okay.
big
Yeah.
one, because patterns can be recognized in the way patients respond or the diagnosis much better with AI than we can do. And so I've been saying for a while to young residents, you know, in 10 years, we're not going to be diagnosticians. The OCT is going to tell you what the patient has. But and everyone says, oh, that won't be fun anymore. Well, yeah, it will, because now we're going to concentrate on the patient. Instead of concentrating on what they have, we're going to know what they have, and we're going to, you know, connect with them, I think, at a more personal level. And I think surgery is going to be increasingly important for delivery of treatment. So I would say, I'm not going to say YP19-1, I'm going to say sustained release delivery systems. That's in general, everybody, something we're all going to be doing. And I think gene therapy, if it is going to be mainstream in our specialty, it has to treat more than inherited retinal dystrophies. It has to treat chronic diseases in a way that we can all deliver it safely and effectively. But I think that's going to happen in the next decade. The ability to have significant diagnoses made outside of the retina specialist's office, even outside the internist's office, through remote and home, oh, things like home OCT and AI, absolutely going to be there.
Yeah.
And you know, when you start to go out 20 years, it's even harder to predict. Are we going to have robotic surgery then? I think we could, but I'm not sure that the value proposition is there. The truth is, we're pretty efficient as eye doctors, and what does Medicare pay us to do a cataract? $600 or something. You're going to have to really spend an awful lot of money to develop a surgical instrument that could do it as well and as cheap as we can. So, you know, I'm going to put that one on hold. And if I could predict 20 years from now, boy, I wouldn't be doing this. I'd be picking stocks and silly sitting on a beach somewhere.
Well, we'll have to,
But
I
I
mean,
do think that my final answer are the two things you mentioned: drug delivery and AI. Those are game changers that I'm almost sure we are going to ch completely change paradigms in 10 years.
Yeah. Well, listen, put it on your calendar. We'll circle back in 10 years and
I hope
we'll
sooner.
see if the predictions were right. Definitely sooner, but we'll this point in particular. So Jay, I want to
Great.
thank you for your time. I
My
know you're a
pleasure.
busy guy. We really appreciate your insights. And the trips down memory lane for sure. And I think no matter what, when you practiced or where you practiced or how you practiced, I think that people are going to appreciate that conversation. So thank you very
Thanks,
much.
Earl. My pleasure. It's been great. Appreciate it.
Thank you for listening in to the New Insight podcast. We really appreciate your time. Be sure to subscribe to our channel on your preferred listening or watching platform. And if you're interested in more ophthalmology news or other podcasts, visit hcplive.com and check out our offerings. For now, I'm Dr. Viral Sheth. Hope to see you next time to discuss what's new in sight.